But it's 12:59, and as the recording has started, we're going to kick off our training today with some housekeeping rules. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clueen for those not able to join us live. The Clueen training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. You can use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time during today's training. We will have two question and answer breaks during the training, the first about halfway through with the last at the end of the sections today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, An Introduction to PFAS, which is based on ITRC's PFAS Teams online resources. My name is Devin Sechkar, and I will be your moderator today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, the federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. So with that, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have served as members of the PFAS team and have volunteered to support the training offered. So with that, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Christy Herzer with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, who is one of the state team leaders of our PFAS team. So with that, Christy, I will hand it off to you for you to get us started.
Great. Thank you so much, Devin. ITRC, the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, is a 501c3 program of the Environmental Council of the States. We're comprised of over 1,000 members, including state, federal, industry, stakeholder, academic, and tribal members. The composition of the ITRC PFAS team follows the trends of the overall membership of ITRC, with just over half of our active members coming from industry, followed by our state members, then our federal members, and then the final slice of the pie is comprised of academic, stakeholder, tribal, and emeritus members. So now we've got a quick poll that will open on your screen, and we'd love for you to fill it out. Which of the following best characterizes your experience with PFAS at environmental sites? Choices are none, less than a year, 2 to 5 years, over 5 years, or if you're thinking about it in terms of sites, zero sites, maybe a couple, maybe more than that, or a whole bunch of PFAS sites. Just as a reminder, this training is intended for those who are relatively new to PFAS. And the answers are coming in. So it looks like pretty much, you know, none or less than a year or 1 to 2 sites. So great. Thank you for participating in that poll. The ITRC PFAS team is comprised of just under 500 professionals across all sectors who come together to share their experience and interest to develop readily accessible technical resources. Our team strives to provide a balanced overview of the current state of knowledge about PFAS in order to support decision-making associated with the management of PFAS contamination. We encourage you to take a look at our consensus-driven free technical resources, which can all be found on our website. You can find our technical and regulatory guidance document, or tech reg for short, which is in the process of being updated with the newest version to be published in September. We also have 13 fact sheets, which will be updated this summer, video modules, and outreach such as today's training. In addition, we have a number of external tables and information you can download and access quickly, such as our soil and regulatory guidance values table, which is updated approximately quarterly. I mentioned our 13 fact sheets, and here's the full list. All of our fact sheets go through the same review process as our tech reg, and so these will also be updated to reflect the current information in the document. The team is working on new content across the document. The ITRC process includes several review steps, internal to the team first, and then external and peer review steps. The final document revisions may differ from the ones shown on this slide. Some information discussed today is new content that will be published in September. And like Devin mentioned, if you're interested in getting involved, please visit itrcweb.org. So now let's move on to the introduction to PFAS sources, physical and chemical properties, and really dive into it. So what I'll be discussing today can be found in the tech reg under section 2. The learning objectives for today include the timeline of PFAS history and use, the major uses of PFAS and potential releases to the environment, and also understanding the introductory information about PFAS chemistry. Like many other emerging contaminants, the emergence of PFAS has followed a familiar timeline marked by five phases: synthesis and development in the 30s and 40s, starting in the 50s, manufacturing and commercial production, then in the 70s, identification of health concerns, and then in the 2000s, detection in the environment, as well as phase outs, reductions, and alternatives. And this slide illustrates the general timeline of these phases for PFAS over the past century. Starting in the 1940s, PFAS use in a wide variety of manufacturing processes and commercial products started. Note that over time, two major processes have typically been used to manufacture PFAS. The first was electrochemical fluorination, which dominated PFAS production until the late 1990s. This process produces a mixture of linear and branched PFAS. And then starting in the 1970s, fluorotelomerization came on the scene and became the dominant production process in the early 2000s. Fluorotelomerization produces primarily even-numbered linear PFAS, and it's important to note that both processes are still in use. Distinctions between production sources and relative abundance of branched PFAS may help with understanding of sources, but this should be approached with caution as other factors such as partitioning, degradation, et cetera, may affect linear and branched PFAS ratios. This pyramid illustrates the emerging awareness of PFAS and the progression of awareness and the emphasis on additional types of PFAS. So starting at the top of the pyramid, the 8 carbon perfluoroalkyl acids, PFOS and PFOA, they received much of the initial attention. And then the sampling and detections in the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule 3 expanded the attention and awareness on additional PFAS. Subsequently, the broader list of perfluoroalkyl acids ranging from 4 to 14 carbons were added to many analyte lists. Then more recently, other classes of PFAS, such as fluorotelomers and per- and polyfluoroalkyl ether acids have been in focus. We're also aware that there are thousands of PFAS that represent the bottom of the triangle. And the bottom of the triangle is not intended to indicate a greater quantity by mass, concentration, frequency, or occurrence. (Clears early 2000s, as concerns were raised regarding the persistence, mobility, bioaccumulation, and potential health risks of some PFAS, efforts began in the US, Canada, Europe, and elsewhere to phase out production of these thought to be the most potentially harmful. These are somewhat generically referred to as long-chain PFAS, which include PFCAs with eight or more carbons and PFSAs with six or more carbons. And I'll get into the chemistry in a little bit. These appear to be more bioaccumulative than perfluoroalkyl acids with shorter chain lengths. However, production has not entirely stopped for PFOA, PFOS, PFHXS, and their associated precursors. Most nations have allowed exceptions for continued limited use of these chemicals, and also a lot of the production is just shifted to other parts of the world. And also, other PFAS are still made in the US today. As PFOA, PFOS, and many of their related precursors have been phased out of use in most Western nations, chemical companies have sought replacement chemistries for their products. These replacements may be shorter chain versions of the same chemicals used before, or they may be polyfluorinated alternatives that degrade to shorter chain PFAAs or don't degrade to PFAAs at all. Although these applications are new, many of these chemicals have been around for decades. Given the existence of these and other replacement compounds, expect our knowledge regarding these chemicals to expand rapidly in the coming years. Given the unique physical and chemical characteristics of PFAS, which impart oil, water, soil, and stain repellency, chemical and temperature resistance, friction reduction, and surfactant properties, they're widely used in a range of products. In both primary production and secondary manufacturing and industry, PFAS are found in surfactants, plastics, resins, metal plating and etching, coatings for carpets, textiles, and paper. Also, PFAS have been used in HFLF or aqueous film-forming foams, which are fluorine-containing class B firefighting foams, which my colleague will tell you about later on. These foams are used to fight fires involving flammable combustible liquids and gases, petroleum, greases, tars, oils, and gasoline, and solvents and alcohols. And you can think of aqueous film-forming foams as being used in military installations, petroleum refineries, firefighting training and response areas. PFAS have been produced on a commercial scale since the 1950s, and production continues today. To date, several major sources have been identified for PFAS releases to the environment. And these are locations where PFAS-bearing aqueous film-forming foams were used or stored, industrial sites where PFAS are produced or used in the manufacturing of industrial or commercial products, landfills, and wastewater treatment plants. Now, within these sites, the potential for PFAS released to the environment and the type and concentrations of PFAS released may vary widely. For example, HFLF sites in industrial facilities with containment and pollution control systems may pose less risk than those without such controls. Similarly, landfills that receive only municipal solid wastes containing consumer products will have some level of PFAS in their waste and leachate, but the concentrations are likely to be much lower than at landfills that receive industrial wastes. In a similar vein, wastewater treatment plants may all have some level of PFAS in their influent and effluent, but to date, significant releases of PFAS from wastewater treatment plants has been linked to industrial waste streams in the system and systems catchment area. This flowchart represents general categories of sources of PFAS exposure and occurrence in the environment. On the left, we have PFAS production, use in manufacturing, use in industrial products, and use in consumer products. This diagram shows, in general, how these sources may result in direct occupational or non-occupational exposure and how PFAS from these sources may enter the environment, which may then result in ecological and/or human exposure. It also reflects the fact that different sources may differ in their relative environmental significance. Now, there's no universally accepted definition of PFAS, but in general, PFAS are characterized by carbon atoms linked together and bonded to fluorine atoms at most or all available carbon bonding sites. And so for the ITRC PFAS team, the references, definitions, and resources that we've used include Buck et al. 2011, OECD 2018 and 2021, as well as US EPA Comtox Chemicals Dashboard. So this simplified family tree shows just one approach for how the thousands of chemicals known as PFAS can be categorized. To begin with, the large family of PFAS can be divided into two major classes, nonpolymers on the left and polymers on the right. In most, excuse me, in most cases, our main concern is with the nonpolymer side of the PFAS family. These nonpolymers are primarily the ones being detected widely in the environment and appear to have levels of bioavailability. Because of this bioavailability, they're of concern to human health or the environment or both. The PFAS we've heard about include a subclass known as perfluoroalkyl substances. The perfluoroalkyl class includes perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs. These are the better known PFAS, which include PFOS and PFOA. Now, perfluorinated simply refers to the fact that the alkyl part of the chemical, the straight chain carbon backbone, is fully fluorinated, and we'll get to that next. The other subclass under the nonpolymer PFAS class is the polyfluoroalkyl PFAS. Polyfluorinated means the carbon backbone is only partially fluorinated. An example of polyfluoroalkyl PFAS that you may have heard about include the fluorotelomer substances often found at firefighting sites where class B foams such as AFFF have been discharged. Some polyfluoroalkyl PFAS and a small subset of polymer PFAS may degrade to form perfluoroalkyl PFAS. PFAS that have the ability to degrade to perfluoroalkyl PFAS are referred to as precursors. Once these precursors degrade to the perfluoroalkyl compounds, they are generally much more stable in the environment and therefore will persist for long periods of time. Now let's focus on the PFAS you're most likely already dealing with, the perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs. At their most basic, PFAAs are made up of a fully fluorinated carbon chain tail and a functional head, a group head. The carbon chain is what makes these chemicals alkanes, and they have the same alkane names we're familiar with from hydrocarbon chemistry, like butane, pentane, hexane, octane. And it's those names that tell us how many carbons are in the molecule. All of the bonding sites on the carbon in the tail have fluorine atoms attached. That makes them per, or fully fluorinated. For PFAAs, there are only two possible functional groups, carboxylates or sulfonates. So sometimes you'll see the acronym PFCA or PFSA to clarify which of the two main types of PFAAs are being discussed. It's an extremely strong carbon-fluorine bond that makes PFAAs nearly indestructible in the environment. Now we can start assembling the names and acronyms of the PFAAs using this simple system, where PF means perfluoro, the X provides the alkane name for the number of carbons, and the Y is either S for sulfonate or A for carboxylate. For example, an 8-carbon chain, octane, with a sulfonate group becomes perfluorooctane sulfonate, or PFOS. An important thing to note is that we count all of the carbons when naming the carboxylates. So even though PFOA has only 7 carbons in its tail, we include the carbon in the CO2 head for a total of 8. So this table shows how the naming system works for all of the PFAAs. Although it only shows carboxylates and sulfonates for 4 to 10 carbons, it does work for longer chain PFAAs too. Already our simple system shows a level of complexity because each chemical, there are two names, two chemical formulas, two Cas numbers. So what's going on here? The two names reflect the fact that PFAAs can be either acids or anions. And these two forms have very different chemical and physical properties. In almost all environmental media, PFAAs will be present as negatively charged anions, the exception being if pH is less than 3. So they should be referred to using the anionic form of their name. However, you'll see the names used interchangeably. When we dig into the chemistry a little bit, you'll see why it's important to know which form you're actually looking at. Some PFAS can exist in the environment in various ionic states, acids, anions, cations, or even Zwitter ions that are both positively and negatively charged. And the charge or charges on the molecule has important implications for their chemical and physical properties. But PFAAs are almost always present in the environment as negatively charged anions, again, except at pH less than 3. However, your lab may be reporting PFAAs as acids in the reports, even though they're present in the environment in their anionic form. So why is that? In the US, it might be because that's how PFAA is listed in the EPA Drinking Water Method 537.1, and the lab is keeping their list consistent with the EPA method. It may also be related to the PFAS standards used by the lab when analyzing the sample. These standards often may be PFAA acids or salts, so the results may be reported using the acid form of the name, even though the PFAA being measured in your sample is the anionic form. And when using PFAA salts as their standard, the lab will run a calculation to account for the mass of the cation to give an accurate measurement of the anion form that's actually present in the sample. The other major class of PFAS we need to be concerned about are the polyfluorinated substances. These PFAS have at least one non-fluorine atom attached to one or more, but not all of the carbon atoms in the alkane tail. This is important because those non-fluorinated bonding sites create a weak link in the chain that may be susceptible to biotic or abiotic degradation. As a result, some polyfluorinated PFAS may be able to degrade to form the more recalcitrant PFAAs. Some polyfluorinated PFAS you may already be familiar with include fluorotelomer sulfonates or fluorotelomer alcohols, which are often detected at sites where aqueous film-forming foam has been discharged. Those PFAS have names with a prefix, such as 6,2 or 8,2, and those numbers tell you how many of the carbons in the tail are fully fluorinated and how many are not. This, in turn, can indicate the maximum number of carbons that may be in the alkane tail of resulting PFAA that forms when the precursor degrades. Degradable PFAS are often referred to as precursors, and the PFAAs that they degrade to are sometimes referred to as terminal PFAAs. It's important to note that once a PFAA is formed, regardless of its chain length, it will not degrade further. PFOA will remain PFOA. It will not break down to a shorter PFAA. This slide shows some of the major precursor PFAS groups and whether they have the potential to break down to PFCAs, PFSAs, or both. And this is just a partial list. The identification of precursor PFAS and evaluation of their degradation pathways and terminal perfluoroalkyl acids are an area of active research, which will likely evolve rapidly over the next few years. And we don't have a section on regulations during this training, but we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that US EPA announced a couple of weeks ago their draft proposed National Primary Drinking Water MCLs. It is under public comment currently, and EPA does plan to finalize the regulation at the end of this year. Now I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Richard Spies.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Richard Spies. I work with the Department of Environmental Conservation. And along with my co-lead, Shalene Thomas, we've been working on the AFFF section of the PFAS document for ITRC. And I'm going to go through a little bit more detail about aqueous film-forming foam and some of the best current management practices that are located in the literature. So what are the objectives that we want to learn about in this short AFFF discussion? We want to give a brief understanding of the classes of foams, one of which is AFFF. We want to talk about the types of AFFF that are out there and some of the other foams that have PFAS in them. And then again, we want to go through some of the best management practices for purchasing and storing AFFF or any foam that has PFAS in it, possible use and replacement of those foams, and treatment and disposal. So what are the classes of firefighting foams? As was mentioned by Christy, there are Class A foams They are not found to have PFAS in them, and they were developed in the 1980s to fight woodland fires. They have been used to fight other structural fires and things like that. But in general, if you hear about a Class A foam, PFAS should not be one of the things you're concerned about. And then there's Class B foams, which is what we'll be discussing for the rest of this talk. And they're involved to use to fight flammable liquid or flammable gas, keeping vapors down, like petroleum, tars, oils, solvents, and alcohols. And many Class B foams contain PFAS, and that's a lot of that was driven by the military. So if we look at the diagram on the left-hand side of this picture, in the yellow, where we talk about the fluorinated foams, the first foams are the AFFF foams, the legacy PFOS AFFF, the legacy fluorotelomer AFFF, and the modern fluorotelomer AFFF. And that's mostly what we'll be discussing in the next couple of slides. And then there's an alcohol-resistant form because there have been alcohols added to petroleum so that they burn better. And then there are other fluorinated foams that we won't go into a lot of detail, although a lot of what we discuss pertains to them as well. And then as people are looking for more modern substitutions for foams that do not contain PFAS, there are the fluorine-free foams that are under the green. But remember, it's the AFFF is the primary foam, the vast majority of what was purchased and used of the Class B foams, and that's what contains the fluorosurfactants, and that's why we'll be focusing on that for the rest of this talk. So what are the AFFF classifications? There's the legacy PFOS AFFF, and as was mentioned earlier, that's the electrochemical fluorination. Gives you both branched and linear isomers. You'll get mostly the PFASs formed in that legacy foam. It was mostly manufactured by 3M under the trade name Lightwater. And almost a good portion of that foam contains the PFSA, PFOS, the acarbon sulfonate. There's also legacy fluorotelomer AFFFs, which was mentioned. And that's the polyfluorinated foams. There will be no sulfonates in there or nothing that degrades to sulfonates. And if you analyze that foam using some of the more common analytical approaches, you won't see any of those compounds in that foam. However, some of the polyfluorinated compounds can degrade in the environment to PFCs that you could identify by common laboratory approaches. And then there's the modern fluorotelomer AFFFs that replace the 8-carbon PFAS. AFFFs. And they were mostly developed because of the phase out, the voluntary phase out of the PFOA and PFOS. They contain more of the short chain PFAS, mostly C6. If you've seen a 5-container drum of it, it'll say C6 and it'll have a nice green leaf on it, indicating it's environmentally friendly, although that jury is out. And it could still have trace amounts of PFOA or precursors that could degrade to some of to PFOA or some of the other PFCAs. So what's the typical composition of AFFF? 3% concentrate, which is a pretty common concentrate to get AFFF in. It's actually more than 60% water. A little bit less than 20% of it are solvents that are used to suppress the vapors and treat the chemicals to keep them down under the blanket that's created. And then as much as 18% of the material could be surfactants. And of that 18%, less than 2% are fluorosurfactants. So as you can see, it's a very small amount of fluorosurfactants inside of AFFF. However, when we're talking about parts per billion and parts per trillion, there are many, many of those in a bucket of AFFF. And as you can see over time, some of the chemical compositions have changed. In the electrochemical fluorination process that 3M used, you can see that it went from almost all PFSs to a mixture of a little bit less of that, and then some PFCAs and a lot of polyfluorinated compounds added as well, as opposed to the fluorotelomerization process, which is almost exclusively the polyfluorinated compounds, 8-2, FTSS, and 6-2, and 4-2. So there are lots of chemicals there that can break down in the environment that one would need to be aware of. And where you have mixtures of all of these together, it's almost impossible to tell which part is what. So how do these foams get into the environment? Pretty common release mechanisms that we see at a lot of facilities. You can have small spills. You can have leaks. One could have firefighting operations where a moderate amount of foam is applied. And maybe at a large fire of a large plane, you could have a large volume one-time discharge. But where you see the really high concentrations are those periodic high volume discharges at firefighting training operations and where equipment is checked and where the material is stored in fire departments. So what are some of the fate and transport of AFFF? If we look at the diagram on the right of your screen, that's the AFFF operation. Many of the other processes on how PFAS gets into the environment are shown in this diagram, but we're going to focus on that application on the left. Very important to fully flush out your conceptual site model so that you can look at possible treatment options for mitigating the impacts of the AFFF application. You have to think a lot about the physical chemical properties, as Christy mentioned earlier. Think about some of the breakdown products that can occur through different chemical processes in the environment, and how some of those breakdowns of PFAs over time can break down into different chemicals such as PFOA. So it's important to understand a little bit about the procurement and good inventory practices. If you're someone who is recommending to a fire department or you work in a fire department that needs to purchase foam, you want to make sure you document what you purchase and have a record of the inventory. You want to obviously make sure that whatever you purchase can do the job that it's purchased to do. For example, if you want to fight a chemical fire, you want to make sure that you have a Class B foam. And you want to make sure it meets some basic standards, whether that's the military standard or the UL standard. And then, you know, what expansion ratio does the fire department want or the person who wants to fight the chemical fire need to fight that fire? And these are the different expansion ratios. 1, 3, and 6% is pretty common. You want to make sure that you handle the material appropriately. It often comes in 5-gallon buckets, but also in 55-gallon drums, larger totes, and even in large suppression systems in large bladder pumps or things like that. And obviously, and pretty clearly, you want to have secondary containment and avoid spills to keep this material out of the environment whenever possible. So what are some possible treatment and disposal options? There's been a lot of work done on that in the past, but there was a comprehensive review done by EPA in 2020. And some of the conclusions that came out of that were things like that fire water and flush water that has AFFF or PFAS in it should be disposed of as generated waste whenever possible. That if you have a large volume of water with lower levels of PFAS in it, you can concentrate that PFAS on a material like carbon to reduce treatment and disposal costs. That concentrates can be stored, which was the number one priority of that report, but many industries are still disposing of it either through incineration, landfilling, or stabilization. And if you do incinerate AFFF concentrate, make sure that it's done at a certified facility that has proper emission controls and high temperature destruction. And always try and follow best management practices to account for all the material that's out there to the best of the ability of whoever's keeping those records. So one of the important things that's really been coming up in the last year or two is talking about replacement foams as people have migrated away from foam that has PFAS in it to fluorine-free foams. You want to make sure that, again, that fluorine-free foam can meet your performance specifications, that it can put out the fire that it's purchased to put out. One of the things that's a big issue for people who are migrating away from fluorinated foams to fluorine-free foams is, do I clean my equipment, my bladder pump, my engine, or do I just replace it? And if I do clean it, how clean do I need to make it? Might be difficult to get it down to zero detectable PFAS, but if that's the case, to what level? And that's all discussed in the new chapter that's coming out on AFFF. Again, only use Class B foams when you need it. Consider other alternatives. We've really been pushing that as a best management practice. There are many opportunities to fight fires with things other than Class B foams. And again, what do you consider? Performance requirements. How do you apply it? And how clean does the system need to be, as I mentioned? So there is a lot of research going on right now. The military, through some of their grants to cert up ESTCP, there's new documents coming out every day to try and follow. But there are other groups that are also studying these, and these are some of the documents that do that. So with that, I think we're moving on to fate and transport. And Robert Burgess from the Alaska DEC is going to take that. So Robert, take it away.
Thanks, Richard. Like Richard said, I'm Robert Burgess. I'm with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I work in the Contaminated Sites Program. And I've been co-lead of the Fate and Transport and Site Characterization Subgroup for ITRC for a couple years now. Let's see. Okay. All right. I have control. So these are the document sections that we're going to draw on for today's Fate and Transport and Site Characterization discussion. All of these sections have content that I'll be presenting on. So our objectives today are to learn the unique characteristics of PFAS, to understand their occurrence and behavior in environmental media, which then will inform site characterization and where to look, how to sample, and what to analyze for. The document identifies, like Christy said earlier, about four major or primary sources, source types of PFAS released to the environment. Again, those are fire training or fire response sites and that use AFFF or other PFAS-containing foams, industrial sites where primary or secondary manufacture occurs, and then landfills and wastewater treatment plants or biosolids. And we have the arrows going from between those because there's a relationship there where landfills might send their leachate to wastewater treatment plants, biosolids might go to a landfill, and so forth. So what is fate and transport? It's put simply, it's the understanding the behavior of chemicals in the environment. So PFAS are somewhat unique in their fate and transport, in their transport properties. So we need to take special considerations when we compare them to other contaminants. But again, fate and transport is informed by your characteristics of the chemical, in this case, PFAS, and then the characteristics of the site, soil properties, groundwater depth and velocity, and so forth. So, apologies. So heads and tails of PFAAs. Again, PFAAs are one subgroup of the fully fluorinated alkyl acids, right? And they are very persistent in the environment. The structure of them is such that they tend to partition at interfaces. They behave like surfactants with the anionic head group, the polar head group being hydrophilic, and the tail group being hydrophobic. So they tend to essentially stick their tails out of the water. And that's also the case at water-oil interfaces. They will be, the head group is generally attracted to the water while the tail group will stick into the oil. Christy mentioned earlier the various types of PFAS that you might find in the environment, the different structures. So in general, we have a lot of different diverse structures of PFAS. It's a chemical class with thousands of compounds. And these, those that are pictured here are just examples of a polyfluorinated anion, a polyfluorinated cation, and a polyfluorinated Zwitter ion. So why is polyfluorinated important? Well, again, if we don't have a fully fluorinated tail, we have sites where microbes or physical processes can come in and break down the PFAS, right? Now, the charge on these molecules is also important. Anions are less likely to sorb to soils compared to cations and Zwitter ions. And so that has important implications for fate and transport. In general, anions will tend to travel further and faster in groundwater than cations and Zwitter ions, which are much more likely to stay sorbed to soil. So anions are typically negatively charged at environmental pH. They're water soluble and they behave like surfactants. They also have a low vapor pressure and Henry's law, so they're not very likely to transfer into air. All right. So anion sorption and transport. Again, PFAAs are very persistent, but they are also fairly mobile, which is differs from some of the persistent pollutants that we're used to. This table kind of summarizes the organic carbon normalized distribution coefficients, or KOC values, and the corresponding hypothetical retardation values for a suite of PFAAs of varying chain lengths. Generally, the shorter anions are going to be transported slightly faster than the longer chain compounds. You know, if you look closely at this table, you notice that there's a few irregularities in that when we get to the really short chains. These are values that are derived from lab studies, and I think that in general, we do see the very short chains leading the edge of plumes in the environment. So it's, you know, these values vary. It's not clear what's controlling this, but we do expect that shorter chain PFAS will travel faster in groundwater than longer chain in general. So if we look at these retardation factors, these are hypothetical. They suggest that PFAS may be transported in groundwater at a speed about 40 times slower, or 1/40th that of the speed of water, at least in this hypothetical aquifer. PFOA, on the other hand, may be transported only 5 times more slowly than the speed of water. So what that tells us is that there's differential transports. You know, so if you start with a mix on one end, the ratios can change as you travel through groundwater. So it is important to note, however, that for PFAS, sorption is not really a straight organic carbon or kit to KOC relationship. There's a lot that is still being researched about that, but what it means is that knowing just the KOC is not sufficient. We also need to understand some information about solution chemistry. For example, low pH and higher polyvalent ions can lead to more sorption and retardation of PFAS. And things like co-contaminants, like if you have NAPL at your site, that can interact with PFAS and retard their movement. So whenever we have a PFAS release, there's usually a mix of different compounds. That includes, again, precursors. In this case, we have a fluorotelomer alcohol pictured. And that can actually break down because it is susceptible to attack at these transformable carbons. So microbes or physical or chemical processes can knock those carbons off and break it down to a compound like PFNA, which will not biotransform and is not biodegradable. So it's important to remember that under appropriate conditions, these polyfluorinated compounds can break down to these fully fluorinated PFAAs. And that's been demonstrated in many studies. Typically, precursor transformation happens under aerobic or oxidizing conditions, but there can be some breakdown in anaerobic conditions as well. There's also polymers, PFAS polymers. They might degrade over longer timescales, but once you get to monomers like those pictured, they will be oxidized to sulfonates and carboxylates. Again, it's important to remember that some precursors are more likely to sorb to soils, like those cationic and zwitterionic compounds that I pictured earlier. And that has important implications for what happens in your source. You have precursors that are trapped in soil, and if the conditions there are aerobic, they might break down. Then the breakdown products are PFAAs that are much more likely to move in water. So as infiltration happens or groundwater moves through, those can be transported. So in other words, having lots of precursors in your source area can lead to a long-term source of PFAAs to groundwater. So PFAS occurrence in environmental media, we're gonna walk through these various media very briefly and talk about some of the processes that are important in each of them. Now, in general, it's the same kinds of processes that are important for any kind of compound, any kind of contaminant, but there are specific differences that we're going to be looking at when it comes to PFAS. Again, some of those processes are partitioning to soil or to air-water interface, uptake by biota, transformation or leaching. In air, we have partitioning to air or aerosols or particulate air transport, and then transformation through processes like photooxidation. Again, in groundwater, partitioning, transformation, matrix diffusion all play important roles, just like they would for any compound. And when you get to surface water, we have the same things. Transformation may occur differently than in groundwater. Partitioning to sediments, to air-water interfaces, and interestingly, foam formation. So that can occur for various reasons, especially in high concentrations. So in atmospheric transport, that can occur on regional scales or global scales. Sources include stuff like stack emissions, incineration, fire suppression, and the nature of the release might determine whether short or long range transport is of greater or lesser concern. Now when you do have short range transport of PFAS, they redeposit in local scales, and that can lead to large impacted areas, large diffuse source areas of soil contamination around certain industrial sites. Again, we do have some PFA precursors that are volatile, specifically the fluorotelomer alcohols, and those can transport in vapor phase or attached to particulates, while other types of PFAS tend to be transported via aerosols and particulates more than in vapor phase. Now in the VADO zone, again, there may be significant retention of precursors, especially cationic or zwitterionic precursors, but it's gonna depend on the soil chemistry. how the extent of that sorption is going to depend on both the amount of organic carbon that you have, as well as clay minerals and cation exchange capacity. And so it's important to understand the specifics of your site in order to understand how much PFAS may be retained. So the types of information that we would want, you know, in general, in any kind of contaminant investigation, we're going to look at subsurface hydrogeology, site features. But for PFAS, again, we want to look at mineral and organic content. Probably be helpful to understand precipitation and infiltration rates when we're thinking about vadose zone transport, occurrence of co-contaminants, and stuff like cation exchange capacity, information on pore size that comes in important, especially when we're looking at partitioning to an air-water interface. And again, keep in mind that any of those sorbed precursor compounds could potentially break down into PFAAs and act as a long-term source. In groundwater, there's lots of similar concerns. We need to understand soil chemistry, but then of course we also have groundwater chemistry to deal with. So again, if we have different pH or a high cation concentration, we might reduce the amount of migration of certain PFAS. So there's a lot to consider here. Again, the organic carbon partitioning is important, but we need to understand more than that when it comes to PFAS in order to truly understand its movement in the environment. It's really important to understand environmental fractionation. When we're talking about the partitioning behavior of PFAS, some are going to sorb more than others. Some are going to travel more than others in groundwater. And that's important to understand because what you see in your source area can be very different from what you might see down gradient in terms of the composition of PFAS. It's also important to note that if we have co-contaminants, co-contaminants themselves can change PFAS behavior in the environment. But also any treatment, any remediation that may have occurred in the past might have an effect on your PFAS composition as well. For example, if there was air sparging or in situ chemical oxidation or any form of oxidizing treatment that was applied for petroleum hydrocarbons, for example, that's going to alter your groundwater chemistry and push it to a more aerobic conditions, which will lead to more precursor degradation and production of PFAAs. So understanding site history, including if there's been co-contaminants and remediation, can be very important as well. This figure is intended to kind of get at that question of environmental fractionation. This is a hypothetical example of PFAS phaeton transport at an AFFF site. So here at the source, we have firefighters training with PFAS, AFFF. And because of the co-contaminants, we're gonna see that it's fairly anaerobic near the source. Due to the fuel being used as a fuel source and oxygen being depleted in order to break it down. You get a little further away, the hydrocarbons are starting to be biodegraded. PFAS plume is expanded. And we'll see some, the hydrocarbons are degraded, we're going to become more aerobic. So that allows for precursor degradations. You go further out, that happens even more. More PFAAs are being produced as precursors break down and hydrocarbons are degrading rapidly at this point. We get out past the hydrocarbon plume, and we see expansion of the PFAS plume with short chain PFAS migrating faster. So again, the take-home message here is that the complexity of the chemistry, and as a result, the complexity of the fate and transport processes can be a function of many things. So how long ago did the release happen? And has there been time for that breakdown to occur and for PFAAs to be produced? That also is going to affect, you know, how long your plume is likely to be. How far away are we from the source or a potential source? Maybe you were far enough away that we wouldn't expect to see certain precursors be transported that far. And then has there been significant remediation of other contaminants? Again, back in the source area, if we've treated that for hydrocarbon contamination in the past, oftentimes that would include techniques that would oxidize the subsurface and push precursor degradation. So those are things that are important to understand. So what are some site characterization issues that are relevant to PFAS? You know, fate and transport is one thing. How does that inform what's important for site characterization? And we'll just go through briefly some site characterization issues that are relevant to PFAS here. One is that it's an evolving science, right? We're still learning a lot about PFAS every day, every week, every year. And that means that regulations are catching up with that science too. So we're still in this state of flux with PFAS where science and regulations are evolving. That also means analytical methodologies might be evolving. So that, as time goes on, is going to be even more important to be able to make sure that older data sets are comparable with newer data sets. Detection and reporting limits might change. We have techniques that that will identify different types of PFAS. Sampling methodologies, because of the ubiquity of PFAS, there's a lot of potential for cross-contamination. It's in a lot of consumer products. Now, generally speaking, there's been some research lately that shows that if you're just using good common sense, that you can minimize that cross-contamination. But it is something that's important to pay attention to and make sure that you're using, when possible, PFAS-free sampling materials. And then the regulatory environment, again, we've got changing limits, sampling procedures, guidance documents are evolving, and compounds of interest might change as well. More on the technical side of things, groundwater can be very significant for PFAS because of its source as drinking water. And again, drinking water is the primary method of exposure to these chemicals. There are other ways to be exposed that are important not to ignore, but drinking water can be a major pathway. Plumes might be quite extensive. Because we've had these products in use for such a long time, it's quite possible that plumes have had time to develop. So they might be found a great distance from your source area. The compound suite is really important to consider. What are you sampling for and why? As the science changes and regulations change and we add more compounds into our list of compounds of concern, PFAS of concern, it might be prudent to sample for a broader suite now, even if you're targeting things that that aren't in regulation yet. But there's also other reasons. For example, we can, with a larger suite of compounds, we can apply some PFAS forensics if that becomes necessary to distinguish between source areas or other sorts of environmental fractionation and so forth. So sampling a broad suite of compounds might be a good idea, and including precursors so we can understand the potential for long-term sources. We also there's a lot of PFAS-specific data analysis and interpretation approaches. Models are being developed, lots of tools that we can use. And it's important to understand the historical view, both of PFAS manufacture and just the site-specific historical information. How long was this fire training area used? What other potential sources might we have in the area that are going to confound our analyses? Those kinds of questions. And then, you know, just remember there's widespread use. So you might encounter offsite contributions. It's important to consider that when you're looking at a sampling and analysis plan. So those are all some very important considerations. And then finally, you know, the unique source, fate, and transport properties of PFAS lead to some unique concerns as well. Again, there's atypical sources, a broad variety of primary sources that might be considered unusual. We might have movement of PFAS from contaminated media into a previously uncontaminated area. That might be something that could occur just through regular fate and transport, but also through use of irrigation wells or movement of contaminated soil that we didn't realize was contaminated at the time. Those kinds of things, so human intervention there. And then we've got precursor transformation. So long-term soil sources, because we have precursors that aren't necessarily something that we can, that we're going to target with our commercially available analytical techniques. We also have atypical pathways. So like I mentioned before, if we have industrial emissions, we might have localized air deposition that results in groundwater impacts with no direct on-site release or no point source, essentially, right? So you got a broad diffuse source area in those instances. Complex transitions between media. We talked about that a little bit on a previous slide. We need to understand a lot about our subsurface chemistry and physical properties in order to truly understand and be able to predict PFAS transport in the subsurface. And then unique partitioning that we talked about as well. So those are all things that we really need to understand. Because of low delineation limits and the mobile nature of PFAS, we really should place extra emphasis on understanding the effects of hydrogeological heterogeneity on the groundwater plume. So that will take us right into our first Q&A break. And thank you.
All right. Thank you, Robert. So we will jump right into our first Q&A break here, and then we will pick back up with the next sections. So the first question I have is going to be for Robert to answer. Are there studies performed to evaluate the potential for PFAS to volatilize into the betazone from groundwater?
That's an excellent question. I am aware of some studies, I'm not super familiar with them, but I am aware of some studies that ask the question about PFAS vapor intrusion. So that question is out there. I don't think we cover it in very much detail in the document because most PFAS that we encounter do not tend to volatilize, and the research there is still ongoing. So there have been studies on that subject. Where we do tend to see more volatile PFAS is in landfills. Landfill sources that tend to have those fluorotelomer alcohols.
All right, thank you, Robert. Next question is going to be for Christy. So you mentioned in your presentation that non-polymers are more widely detected than polymers. Is this because non-polymers are more widespread or because chemical analysis has mainly focused on non-polymers?
Yep. Thank you, Devin. And great question. If you think back to the pyramid that I showed, our analysis has mostly been focused on the non-polymer side of the tree. And so that is why We've been seeing those. So we've been looking for them. We're able to see them. So as our awareness has expanded, now our analytical techniques are also expanding.
All right, thank you, Christy. Next question is going to be for Robert. Can you talk about the amount of organic carbon or clays in the soil that retain PFAS or enhanced degradation?
Yeah, so so in general, as you increase organic carbon, you can increase sorption of PFAS. And when it comes to clay minerals, again, increased mineral content might result in increased sorption of certain types of PFAS. It's going to be a site-specific question. You're going to want to look at data from your site that includes mineral content. And you can also do leaching studies on PFAS. The real important thing to remember when it comes to PFAS is that you can't rely on those calculated values of KOC values. You really need to get site-specific information. I hope that answers the question.
All right. Thank you, Robert. And just for any of the attendees, if you had a question that wasn't fully answered, feel free to, to enter a clarifying statement in the Q&A pod for us. So next question. So I see that Bill's answering it, but I think that we will still read it out loud. How is chain length determined? Christy, I think you can talk about this.
Sure, thanks, Devin. So chain length is determined by the number of carbons in the alkene tail. Now we do count all the carbons in the carboxylate, so that includes the carbon in the functional head. So even though PFOA has 7 carbons in the tail, the carbon in the head group is also counted. I should point out that PFAS are human-made compounds. So the chemical companies create compounds that serve various uses. So the answer is either, chain length is determined by, the chemistry of the carbons in the tail plus the functional group for carboxylates, or the answer is humans determine the chain length.
All right. Thank you, Christy. I know we're leapfrogging here, but Robert, the next question's for you. Is there an existing list of common co-contaminants that influence PFAS fractionation or transport?
That's a good question. I don't know that anyone's generated a specific list. I think that it's most studied in the terms of co-contamination with hydrocarbons at a fire training sites. The general trend is that if there's L-NAPL present or significant hydrocarbon contamination, that can reduce the movement of PFAS in the environment because of those because of the tendency to partition at interfaces. There's some work that I've heard about, but not really been able to find that suggests that co-contamination with solvents can also be a concern, and that might actually lead to facilitated transport. But don't quote me on that. That's something, again, I haven't been able to find that research. I've just heard about it. So I think in general, it's most studied with petroleum co-contaminants again.
All right. Thank you, Robert. The next question is going to be open for all of our trainers. Are there any published studies on average plume lengths for PFAS released at fire training facilities?
That is a great question. You might check out section 6 of our document. That's occurrence. I'm not sure that specific question is tackled there or not. But I can speak anecdotally to that because I'm aware of several sites that my colleagues or myself manage in Alaska where we have plumes that are over a mile long. Those are for sites that have been they've been used for fire training for many, many years or decades. So I think that the answer is, it's difficult to say that you can, we can predict at any particular site that we're going to have a mile long plume or 2 miles. They can get very long. And I think that one thing that is sometimes prudent when you've discovered a PFAS source is, especially an AFFF source that's been used for many years, it's a great idea to look further down gradient than you might in an initial, in some other kind of site characterization effort. So especially if there's drinking water resources that should be protected, that's one thing that you can do because there are certainly reports of very long plumes. I don't know off the top of my head if there's something that actually gives an average length, but it's not atypical to see plumes that are over a mile long with PFAS.
All right, thank you, Robert. Next question is going to be for Richard. Can you talk about states requiring specific destruction efficiency for PFAS thermal treatments?
Yeah, so there's nothing in the document that references that. So I don't know of any state-specific requirements. In the EPA document that I mentioned in my part of the talk, because of concerns about incineration and possible incomplete combustion or byproduct production, EPA is currently recommending storing AFFF and not disposing of it until more research can be done. And there is a lot of research going on in that particular venue. So I think the jury is stay tuned, but if you do decide to dispose of it, do it at an appropriate facility that uses high temperatures and stack emission controls.
All right. Thank you, Richard. So with that, we are going to move to our next section, which is going to be PFAS sampling and analysis with Christy Herzer again. I would just like to remind all of our attendees that we do have one more question and answer break at the end of the training. So keep those questions coming in and we will address them at the end. All right, Christy.
Thanks, Devin. All right, so now I'll be talking about sampling and analysis, and the content is covered in section 11 of the tech reg, as well as one of those amazing resources that I spoke about in the beginning of the presentation, some of those external files. So we'll go over elements that make PFAS sampling different from other sampling events, go over best practices for preparing and conducting PFAS sampling events, go over the PFAS analytical methods, the current state, some basics about compound-specific PFAS analysis, and then some alternative analytical techniques and how they can be useful. So for PFAS sampling events, it's important to have a quality assurance project plan or site-specific work plan, as routine sampling plans don't adequately address PFAS-specific concerns. These plans should include PFAS-specific sampling standard operating procedures, SOPs, which help improve sampling consistency and overall data quality. Federal and state agencies, as well as consulting firms, have developed guidelines, checklists, and standard operating procedures, and a list of examples can be found in Section 11 of the tech reg. And we're mostly focused on items that come into contact with the sample that's being collected, and you can pretest items that are used in the sampling event or collect equipment rinse blanks. When planning for and preparing for a sampling event, it's important to consider project objectives, site history, project action levels. The site history can indicate whether extremely high concentrations of PFAS may be expected in some areas, such as a fire training area. This information should be considered when determining the frequency of quality control samples, such as decontamination blanks. The project action levels should be considered when determining what the project's definition of PFAS-free is, for which sampling equipment, supplies, and field quality control will be evaluated against. So due to all these issues, it is important to develop PFAS project-specific sampling and analysis plans. All sampling and analysis requires communication with the lab from the planning stage through the data reporting stage. However, PFAS projects may require additional communication. With respect to PFAS, this communication includes discussion of verification requirements for sampling supplies, both the analyte list, the definition of PFAS-free for the project, the need for additional sample bottles for additional quality control, the volume of sample required to achieve the laboratory reporting limit, and the project sample preparation requirements. In addition, the project should communicate if samples are suspected to contain extremely high concentrations of PFAS, as that concentration in the sample often dictates the appropriate sample preparation technique to be used. So if these samples are prepared without this consideration, it can cause significant cross-contamination issues during sample prep and contaminate analytical instrumentation, which will cause extensive delays in sample analysis and potentially affect the data usability. PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events due to an increased potential for contamination of your sample to occur. What do we mean by that? It's the unintentional introduction of PFAS to your sample during sample collection, shipping, storage. There are three main reasons for this increased contamination potential. First, the extremely low PFAS screening or regulatory criteria results in the concentration which defines contamination to be unusually low. Second, PFAS can exist at a sampling location at concentrations orders of magnitude higher than the screening or regulatory criteria. And because of this, there's an increased risk that routine decontamination processes will be inadequate and cause the samples to become cross-contaminated. And third, some sampling equipment and materials typically used for sampling contain or may contain PFAS. So to determine if the sampling equipment and materials could contain PFAS, make sure to review any appropriate safety data sheets, SDS, and or product specification documents to determine if any sort of PFAS or fluoropolymer content may be indicated. But keep in mind, even if it's not listed on the SDS, it doesn't completely assure a material to be PFAS-free. In the absence of confident information, perform testing of the materials prior to any sampling event to vet the potential for any impacts to your sampling event. The rule of thumb is, when in doubt, check it out. Collect equipment blanks and extra quality control samples and or have your laboratory test the materials prior to the sampling event. Also, a part of the coordination that should be performed with your laboratory is to assure that the entire container used to collect the sample will be used for the extraction and analysis as defined by each of the EPA methods. Therefore, even if a lab requests 500 milliliters of water per sample, if the method 537.1 or 533, for example, uses 250 mils per analysis, that necessitates the collection of two 250 milliliter containers. Some of the supplies needed for your sampling event need to be supplied by the laboratory that will be performing the analysis. These include sample containers, solvents used in decontamination processes, and water used for blanks in the field and the final rinse of equipment. The lab must verify that these supplies are PFAS-free as defined by your project objectives prior to shipping to the field, and also provide project with documentation of this verification. If for some reason site water or water other than lab supplied water is used, and make sure a sample of this is sent to the lab for analysis. When using reusable equipment in the field, a close review of the SDS for the soaps and detergents to be used for field decontamination is important. Any soap or a detergent that contains proprietary fluorosurfactants maybe avoid those. And in fact, the recommendation is to use soaps that have been previously used and tested. Even if the soap or detergent doesn't contain fluorosurfactants, and some knowledge about the container that the soaps are in can be important. If large equipment is being used, it's likely too expensive, too cumbersome, and inconvenient to only use the lab supply PFAS-free water. So site water can be used for the bulk of the decontamination, and then the PFAS-free water used for the final rinse. Ultimately, the plan created for the site and sampling event should fully describe the field quality control needed to fulfill and complement the quality control necessary. However, if the sampling event involves a mix of non-potable water methods and drinking water methods, you need to make sure the additional requirements of the drinking water methods are met, like the frequency of field reagent blanks, the use of field duplicates, and the frequency of matrix spikes. If the drinking water analyses for the samples are used for or considered for compliance, the omission of some of these additional criteria could invalidate the sample data that's generated. With all the unknowns associated with PFAS sample collection and the possibility that detection of extremely low levels of some PFAS may trigger regulatory actions, it's critical to have as much quality assurance and quality control data as possible to evaluate the validity of your results. This includes equipment blanks, field blanks, and field reagent blanks. In general, you shouldn't field filter PFAS water samples to avoid loss of PFAS onto the filter. Alternatives include the use of low flow sampling techniques, as well as centrifuging in the lab. If lab filters are utilized, they must ensure that it's rinsed with the extraction solvent during processing. Now let's move on to PFAS analysis. There are two EPA methods applicable to drinking water sampling analysis, 537.1 and 533. They have different analyte lists with some crossover, and both are required under the fifth unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, or UCMR5. EPA 537.1 and 533 have some strong similarities. Both require field reagent blanks, samples prepared using solid phase extraction, and both methods are multi-lab validated. They do have some differences. They use different chemical preservatives, and there are different collection processes required. For analysis, they have different holding times, different analyte lists, which we'll go over, and then they have different quantification schemes, which we'll go over in a few slides. The analyte lists, we have 14 PFAS common to both methods. Four are unique to EPA 537.1 on the left. Those compounds are required under UCMR5 to use 537.1 to report those four PFAS. And then 11 PFAS are unique to 533. EPA draft method 1633 is the result of a collaborative effort between DOD and EPA to develop a method for PFAS in a wide range of media. It was published as a draft method following the completion of single laboratory validation study and holding time studies. This method is applicable to 40 PFAS in groundwater, wastewater, surface water, leachate, biosolids, tissue, sediment, and soil. Currently, the draft is undergoing multi-lab validation, and the wastewater section was just completed in the third draft in December. Other test method 45, or OTM 45, is a detailed and complicated sampling and analysis technique that determines PFAS in particulate are adsorbable and soluble phases. Extracts are analyzed for targeted compound analysis, but could be analyzed using a non-targeted analysis approach. However, there's no detailed procedure for the non-targeted analysis, as it's still an emerging area of analysis. POD AFFF01 is applicable to AFFF concentrates for the determination of the concentration of PFOA and PFOS for the qualification and compliance to the mil-spec. Laboratories must be DoD ELAP accredited to perform this method in order for the results to be used for compliance and qualification. So the following slides consider all of the methods we've just discussed. There are some key consistencies between all of these methods. All utilize liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry that use analytical standards to identify and quantify individual PFAS. The analyte list for these methods do not include neutral or volatile PFAS, such as the fluorotelomer alcohols. For all of these methods, the same equipment and supply concerns associated with field sampling apply. The PFAS analytical methods landscape is changing, and we try to stay as current as we can. Check the PFAS website for up-to-date information. There are also some significant ways in which these methods differ that need to be considered when you're selecting a method. First, the scope of these methods vary greatly. The media that each method has been validated for varies along with the limits of detection and the limits of quantitation that are achievable in each method, in each media varies. The method analyte lists also vary. Another significant difference between these methods is their sample preparation process. Methods prepare either the whole sample in a container rinse, or an aliquot of the sample collected. Preparation of an aliquot of the sample is not recommended due to its potential to bias low quantitation of individual PFAS. In addition, if the whole sample is prepared without inclusion of a solvent container rinse, it also presents the potential, although to a lesser extent, to bias low quantitation of individual PFAS. Methods also differ in their mode of preparation and their level of sample cleanup. Now, the quantitation scheme utilized by each method varies. There are three quantitation schemes possible: external standard, internal standard, and isotope dilution quantitation. Depending on the scheme used, bias associated with sample preparation, instrumentation, and matrix interference may or may not be accounted for in the quantitation of individual PFAS. For instance, external quantitation does not account for any of these biases. Internal standard quantitation accounts for instrumentation bias only, and EPA method 537.1 is an example using internal standard quantitation. And then isotope dilution is the gold standard, accounts for sample preparation and instrumentation bias, as well as matrix interference. And EPA 533 and 1633 use isotope dilution. Without the proper review and or validation of the data generated by PFAS methods, the usability of the data cannot be evaluated. EPA has published guidance for the review and validation of PFAS data for drinking water in accordance with EPA method 537.1. EPA also has a technical bulletin that outlines the general principles of PFAS data review. DOD's validation guidance is in the process for data generated using EPA method 1633, and a summary of key points for them, for these data validation guidance documents is available as an external table on the ITRC website. In recent years, a number of non-targeted analysis techniques have been developed and employed primarily by research laboratories, but with the recent increase in interest in evaluating precursors and total fluorine, some commercial laboratories do now offer total oxidizable precursor assay and extractable or adsorbable organic fluorine. These methods lack published multi-laboratory validated methods and are primarily qualitative in nature, and the results require a fair amount of interpretation. Some sites have used the TOP assay to evaluate the total PFAS load on the treatment systems in order to help determine the proper changeout cycles for media. For the most part, these techniques are mainly used as screening tools to evaluate the total mass of fluorinated compounds at a site. And with that, I'll pass it to my colleague, Andy Sfolko from Brown and Caldwell.
Awesome. Thank you, Christy. Just make sure I've got control. There we go. So good afternoon. My name is Andy Sofolko, and I am a senior environmental engineer at Brown and Caldwell. And I co-lead the ITRC's PFAS treatment subgroup with my colleague, Cliff Shirk, with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for hanging with us. I know it's a lot to take in. Treatment technologies will be the final section of today's training before we wrap for one last Q&A session. The TechReg guidance document evaluates the different treatment technologies based on their maturity and market readiness. ITRC has grouped the technologies into three categories: field implemented, limited application, and developing technologies. Today's training will primarily address the field implemented technologies for both PFAS impacted liquids and solids. For additional information and discussion of limited application and developing technologies, please refer to the web document. ITRC is in a continual state of updating the web-based document, and the most recent published revision was in June 2022, but we are currently in the midst of another round of major updates, and that will kind of impact some differences regarding the stages of development and the technologies that I'll discuss in today's presentation, and those that you might find on the web document. So the ITRC treatment technology writing subgroup has defined the three primary categories that I previously discussed for evaluating and classifying the different treatment technologies. First, we have field implemented technologies, which are those demonstrated at multiple locations by multiple practitioners and are generally well documented in either practice or peer-reviewed literature. Next, we have limited application technologies, which may have been field implemented, but at a limited number of sites by a limited number of practitioners and are generally not as well documented. And finally, we have developing technologies, which are those that have only been demonstrated at the lab or bench scale, typically by a limited number of research groups and have not been widely vetted. Over time, we certainly expect and anticipate technologies may advance from developing technologies to limited application technologies, or from limited application technologies to field demonstrated technologies. So the technical classifications can change as a reflection of advances in the individual technologies development. And in fact, during this most recent update to the guidance document, some technologies graduated from limited application to field implemented. And I will make note of those as we discuss them. As a reference in the TechReg document, there is one technology summary table for liquids and one technology summary table for solids. The technologies are tabulated according to the technology's treatment mechanism, documented PFAS treated by the given technology, different pros and cons, waste management, technology maturity, and references for additional reading. There are many technologies that are in the process of scaling up or in the proof of concept phase of development. And really in the treatment technology summary tables, ITRC is trying to capture the technologies that have been documented or published, but weren't fully discussed or contemplated in the main body of the technical reg document. The summary tables in Chapter 12 can help you screen and look up specific technologies that may be fully demonstrated, be in the limited application category or still under development, and that is identified within each summary table. So now we get into the discussion of individual field implemented technologies, and we're going to start with field implemented technologies to address PFAS impacted liquids. So currently, the application of effective liquid treatment technologies are all separation-based technologies. So in other words, they separate and concentrate the PFAS from the bulk phase into either a solid phase or a lower volume liquid fraction. And the section numbers listed here on this slide will point you to the sections within the web-based document where you can get more information on each of these different categories. when it comes to identifying and selecting a treatment technology, the individual treatment objectives are critical and can certainly be a primary and key component to the technology that is selected for application. It's important to keep in mind that, you know, site-specific conditions, in addition to a rapidly changing, you know, regulatory framework, will compound, you know, the importance of doing a site-specific evaluation when identifying appropriate technologies. So adsorption technologies using granular activated carbon or GAC and ion exchange resin or IX are the most commonly adopted technologies because of their demonstrated and documented effectiveness in PFAS removal. GAC has a longer history of deployment, but ion exchange is rapidly becoming widely adopted as well. The design of these systems typically involves a lead lag vessel configuration, and this allows for the operational resiliency to continually meet the low treatment targets associated with PFAS. Pre-treatment is a consideration and is typically key to maximizing the adsorbent performance, and the pre-treatment needs will be largely dictated on the source water quality at the given site where they're being considered. GAC and IX technology do generate waste streams, most prominently as spent media when the media has become exhausted, and that media will require off-site disposal or management. And so the options and costs for waste management associated with spent media should be considered in the life cycle cost estimates developed for these technologies. And it's always important to be mindful that, you know, impending hazardous substances designation or other regulatory movement around, you know, PFAS designations in the RCRA or CERCLA framework could certainly have an impact on waste disposal options for spent media and the associated costs. So as stated previously, GAC has a long tenure of application for PFAS treatment. It's been widely utilized in the greater water treatment industry for numerous applications. And as a result, we know a lot about it, and we know a lot about how to operate GAC systems. So if necessary, GAC is a great option for emergency deployment. Or, you know, if you need to ramp up a treatment alternative quickly, GAC can certainly meet that need, maybe while other treatment alternatives are evaluated. There are three primary types of GAC feedstock. In other words, the feedstock being the raw materials used to make the GAC. Primarily, commercial GAC is made from bituminous coal, subbituminous coal, or coconut shell. And to date, the studies published around GAC in the context of PFAS removal, bituminous coal-based GACs are often showing better performance, specifically with regards to PFAS removal. Just some things to note that you can observe on this graph, on the figure. In general, carboxylates will break through faster than their sulfonate counterparts, and that short chain or polyfluorinated PFAS will typically break through sooner relative to the perfluorinated or long chain alternatives. Moving on to some GAC specific design and operating considerations. The industry has really standardized around an empty bed contact time of about 10 to 15 minutes for each GAC vessel in lead lag configuration. The site-specific water quality will dictate the pretreatment needs. Elevated concentrations of dissolved iron or high organic content are common examples of foulants that can contribute to scaling or biological growth that will ultimately result in diminished performance of a GAC system. And if the GAC vessels are not designed or do not include an upstream filtration as pretreatment, standard operating procedure would dictate, you know, routine backwashes to remove accumulated fines within the system. And really, as with any adsorbent media, it is important to properly condition the media during commissioning. And that could include, different cycling of rinses and such. And product manufacturers will provide guidance on how to properly condition the media before it's completely brought online. Moving on to the anionic ion exchange resins as a field implemented technology. Similar to GAC, ion exchange is a very scalable technology that can be used for very small flows or very large flows based on the amount of infrastructure that you need to install. Ion exchange similarly does require pretreatment and has startup and commissioning media conditioning requirements prior to bringing the media online. Where we depart from GAC is that ion exchange media typically has a shorter contact time relative to GAC, typically on the order of 2 to 4 minutes relative to the 10 to 15 that we'd see for GAC, which relates to a smaller footprint from a number of vessels and the space that you have to dedicate to an ion exchange system will be smaller than you would have to dedicate for a GAC system. Ion exchange is also more selective for PFAS than GAC, and as a result, it will have a higher PFAS adsorption capacity on a per mass of adsorbent basis. But with that in mind, ion exchange is typically more expensive relative to GAC, and the selection between GAC and ion exchange at a site is often driven by site-specific factors. Therefore, site-specific testing is highly encouraged to inform the selection process for GAC or ion exchange, looking at life cycle costs and performance and balancing those against treatment objectives. One thing to be aware of regarding ion exchange is the emergence of regenerable ion exchange resins for PFAS treatment. The operating configuration of regenerable ion exchange is similar to the single-use ion exchange with regards to lead lag configuration, the need for pretreatment and prefiltration. But the capability to regenerate the resin on site, which will return a bulk of the original adsorbent capacity. Just note that separate process infrastructure is necessary to support the resin regeneration and the disposal of the highly concentrated brine waste, typically containing high concentrations of PFAS, is something that will have to be managed. Moving on to high-pressure membranes, high-pressure membranes have a long history of application in the drinking water, wastewater, and water reuse space. High-pressure membrane applications do target a large swath of, for removal of both organic and inorganic constituents in water, to the extent that applications of reverse osmosis, or RO, typically require that treated water be remineralized to reduce its corrosivity. High-pressure membranes serve as a physical barrier in PFAS treatment applications, which do provide an additional level of assurance that PFAS spanning a large range of physical and chemical properties are being removed. However, the downside is that the recovery of these systems is often limited by the feed water quality and typically results in a concentrated reject water residual that requires off-site management and disposal that could represent between 10 and 25% of the influent volume of feed water. So, managing that concentrated water residual is a major concern when considering the application of high pressure membrane systems and really dominates whether or not a high pressure membrane application will be viable. Identifying nanofiltration or NF membranes, which is kind of the next step up as far as, next step down with regards to selectivity in the world of high pressure membranes, identifying NF membranes that are more resistant to fouling while maintaining high PFAS selectivity is an active area of research, and that the development of those membranes will increase overall system recovery and therefore reduce the amount of residuals requiring management. Foam fractionation is an example of a liquids treatment technology that graduated from limited application to a field implemented technology. And as discussed in the fate and transport section, Many PFAS concentrate at the air-water interface, and high concentrations have been observed in PFAS foams that form on contaminated water bodies. Foam fractionation really leverages the surfactant behavior of some PFAS, and it can be applied with ozone, as in ozone fractionative catalyzed reagent addition, or OCRA, or by using air as the formation of two form bubbles that will ultimately accumulate the PFAS in the foam fraction. Foam fractionation has been applied at full scale for PFAS at a limited number of sites, mostly in Australia, Tasmania, and Europe. And really the fundamental mechanism is that air or ozone is bubbled up through the columns to attract the PFAS to the air-water interface. That foam collects at the top of the column where it is collected and then collapsed back into a liquid. That particular concentrate from that first stage will be sent to subsequent stages to further concentrate that PFAS. The resulting foam concentrate represents a much smaller fraction of volume and significantly reduces the volumes requiring management or further treatment for offsite disposal. In some cases, ion exchange media, carbon or RO systems may be used in combination with foam fractionations to polish the effluent and get to non-detect levels, or to address specifically short chain PFAS, which are less susceptible to the mechanisms that foam fractionation relies on. Colloidal activated carbon is another recent addition to the field implemented technologies for liquids treatment, and represents the only in situ approach in this category. The core mechanisms underpinning colloidal activated carbon treatment are very similar to their ex situ GAC analog. However, colloidal activated carbon is unique in its delivery and particle size. The colloidal activated carbon is injected into the subsurface to mitigate the vertical and horizontal migration of dissolved phase PFAS impacts. And the colloidal activated carbon particles are typically around 2 microns in diameter, which promotes their distribution in the subsurface, in addition to increasing the adsorption kinetics and enhanced per mass adsorbent capacity based on this increase in surface area. The longevity of PFAS adsorption in situ is dependent on many factors, many of them site-specific, and remains an active area of study. Existing models do indicate that PFAS are demobilized on the order of decades, but again, site-specific testing can support the development of long-term performance estimates. So when we talk about liquids treatment, it's often necessary to combine the treatment technologies into an integrated remedial solution to achieve the given project objectives. So while integrated technologies can be needed to address multiple media, whether it be soil or groundwater, this slide really focuses on the treatment of water. The water may contain competing background matrix elements like TOC or TSS or TDS that might interfere and reduce the effectiveness of a given PFAS treatment technology. So an integrated solution that will manage these elements prior to the selective PFAS treatment technology will greatly increase the efficiency of your PFAS treatment technology, and certainly should be something that you consider when addressing PFAS treatment at a given scenario or at a given site. Moving on to solid treatment technologies, so we've wrapped up our field implemented liquids treatment technologies, and we're going to move on to solid field implemented solids treatment technologies. For solids such as soils, sediments, and sludge, there are a handful of field demonstrated technologies such as excavation and disposal, soil stabilization, and soil washing. Down in the developing or limited application technologies, we have absorption, stabilization, solidification, and both in situ and ex situ thermal treatments. And I would encourage you to refer to the TechReg web-based document for additional information regarding those technologies, because we're going to focus on the field-implemented technologies. So classic dig and haul, long-standing remedial approach for soils can be used to manage PFAS-impacted soils. When landfilling, certainly check with The landfiller, the shifting regulatory framework around PFAS, not all disposal locations are managing PFAS impacted materials, and PFAS pending PFAS designation as a CERCLA hazardous substance might further complicate that situation. You can dig and send offsite for incineration. That's also an option, but US EPA and DOD, amongst others, are closely investigating the fate and transport of PFAS impacted materials under various incineration conditions. And so while under the most extreme incineration conditions, destruction is assumed, it has not been very well documented and remains an active area of study. Soil stabilization is another application for PFAS impacted soils, and essentially involves creating a cocktail of different soil amendments to promote the binding and demobilization of PFAS within the soil's fraction. There are similar questions regarding longevity, how long will the PFAS be demobilized, and it's possible to bring this technology both in situ and ex situ. Finally, we have soil washing, which separates the fines from the bulk soil matrix. And really, we believe that PFAS are most strongly associated with the fines in the soil matrix. So if you can remove the PFAS impacted fines, you'll significantly reduce the overall PFAS mass within the bulk matrix and greatly reduce the amount of impacted solids that'll have to be managed for offsite disposal. If your soil has a large quantity of or a large proportion of fines, this technology might no longer be cost effective. And there are also water side streams that require treatment. And finally, incineration is a mature technology that has been used for various solid and liquid wastes. But its impacts on PFAS treatment are less known, and again, is an active topic of study. Air emissions are not discussed here. And in terms of specific technologies, we're looking at stack gas emissions and best available technologies to promote a higher level of assurance for PFAS, complete PFAS mineralization during the incineration process. As previously stated, DOD is taking a look at the effectiveness of incineration. So I would certainly, look at incineration closely before pursuing that alternative. And I think that does it for me.
All right. Thank you, Andy. We will jump right into our last Q&A break of the training here today, and then we will wrap up the training. So the first question for our trainers, are there any byproducts produced if PFAS is incinerated? Does it depend on the temperature?
Yeah, I can address that. So yes, I would say that the temperature, we know that temperature has become an important factor in the overall ability of incineration to completely mineralize PFAS, and complete mineralization meaning, breaking every carbon fluorine bond present in the PFAS molecules. And the work that's being done is being done to investigate the efficacy of, what are the critical temperatures? What are the critical residence times required to get to a very high degree of PFAS mineralization?
Right. Thank you, Andy. Next question. Has any of the foam used at car washes been found to contain PFAS or PFOS? I believe that this one will be open for all of our trainers.
Anybody from history and use, I can take a stab. Not that I'm specifically aware of, however, we do know that PFAS has been widely adopted in various, polishes and waxes. So what's used at a car wash, I can't say specifically, and I'm not aware of any specific instances of that. However, You know, it's certainly possible that different car care products might contain PFAS.
All right, thank you, Andy. Do any of our other trainers have any thoughts on that? All right. Next question. Is there a magic number that separates what defines a short chain versus a long chain of PFAS? Are PFAS chemicals identified on MSDS sheets as long chain or short chain?
Yeah, thanks, Devin. So when thinking about long chain and short chain, our TechReg really relies on OECD's definition of this, and that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's an intergovernmental organization. And so based on their definition, long chain refers to perfluorocarboxylic acids with 8 or more carbons, so 7 or more are perfluorinated, and then perfluorosulfonic acids with 6 or more carbons, 6 or more are perfluorinated. Whereas short chain, BPFCAs with 7 or fewer carbons, so 6 or fewer are perfluorinated, and then PFSAs with 5 or fewer carbons, so 5 or fewer are perfluorinated. And we do have a table that you can access that illustrates the difference between the short chain and long chain. And as far as if they're indicated on SDS, I don't believe that they would be, no.
Great. Thank you, Christy. Next question, I believe, is going to be for Richard. Can you talk about fluorine, or is fluorine-free foam actually fluorine-free, or is it just not detectable to a certain concentration? How is this tested or verified?
So there's nothing in our document that specifically references that. We're working on a table in the next iteration that will have more detail on fluorine-free foams, so stay tuned. But I do know of research that's been done in other locations, and some foams that have claimed to be fluorine-free have been found to have fluorine in them. Now, whether that fluorine is in some nature other than PFAS, I think mostly it's total fluorine is what they're testing for. So let the buyer beware. And if you're thinking about purchasing a fluorine-free foam, consider testing it or requiring the manufacturer to show you that they've tested it to show that it is indeed fluorine-free.
All right. Thank you, Richard. Next question. I believe this is going to be for Christy. What is the analysis method for method 533, if not LC-MS or MS?
It is liquid chromatography tandem mass spec. So both 537.1, 533, really all of the methods that I touched on use that liquid chromatography tandem mass spec.
Great, thank you, Christy. Next question. How should I test PFAS in stormwater runoff? Any recommended methods?
I'll take that one, Devin. Yep. So for your non-potable water, your non-drinking water matrices, that's going to be 1633. So stormwater, even though it's not explicitly called out, I would definitely say that 1633 would be the method to look for that.
All right. Thank you, Crispy. Next question. Once the activated carbon is saturated and no longer viable, how is it disposed?
Yeah, so there are several options for that. A common one is sending it back. A lot of the manufacturers will accept it back and regenerate it. And, to date, the regeneration process is shown to destroy the PFAS. You can also incinerate it, send it off for incineration, or landfill it.
All right, thank you, Andy. All right, so we are about out of time here. So just to keep, just to give everybody their final wrap-up information, we will end the webinar here. And if we didn't get to your questions, feel free to reach out to us directly at itrc@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to reach out to our trainers directly. Their information is included on the Clue-In training page that brought you here today under the presenters tab. So you are absolutely welcome to touch base with any of them on any questions that were answered or unanswered. And we would absolutely love to hear back from everybody on how the training went today. So please be sure to fill out the feedback form at the end of the training, which is also available on the Clue-In training page. And that is how you would obtain a certificate of completion for today's training as well. So with that, I'm going to just say thank you to our expert panelists and trainers for being here today. And a special thank you to all of our attendees for joining us for and we hope that we will see you for future ITRC training webinars. So with that, I will wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day. And thank you again.